furthering scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. Greetings from Technocracy News. Patrick Wood here, Editor-in-Chief. And isn't it ironic that the brainiacs that are creating all the artificial intelligence programs and the robots around the world never expected to lose their jobs because of the automation they're creating? But somebody has finally noticed and picked up on this, which is the headline of the first story. AI could most affect knowledge workers. Those are the ones that deal primarily with knowledge, not with their hands, but with their brains. I wrote at the top of this article, technocrats who are inventing AI algorithms by the hundreds, probably thousands, may inadvertently have their own work replaced by their own inventions. Knowledge and white-collar workers are now in the crosshairs for job replacement. Well, that puts a shoe on the other foot. The article states the robot revolution has long been thought of as apocalyptic for blue-collar workers whose tasks are manual and repetitive. A widely cited 2017 McKinsey study said 50% of work activities were already automatable using current technology, and those activities were most prevalent in manufacturing. New data suggests white-collar workers, even those whose work presumes more analytic thinking, higher paychecks, and relative job security, may not be safe from the relentless drumbeat of automation. That's because artificial intelligence, powerful computer tech like machine learning that can make human-like decisions and use real-time data to learn and improve, has white-collar work in its sights. According to a new study by Stanford University economist Michael Webb and published by the Brookings Institution, the scope of jobs potentially impacted by AI reaches far beyond white-collar jobs like telemarketing, a field that has already been decimated by bots, into jobs previously thought to be squarely in the province of humans. Knowledge workers like chemical engineers, physicists, and market research analysts. The new research looks at the overlap between the subject-noun pairs in AI patents and job descriptions to see which jobs are most likely to be affected by AI technology. So, for example, job descriptions for market research analysts, a relatively common position with a high rate of AI exposure, share numerous terms in common with existing patents, which similarly seek to analyze data, track marketing, and identify markets. It's more forward-looking than other studies in that it studies patents for technology that might not yet be fully developed or deployed. Typically, estimates of automation effects on the workplace, which vary widely depending on the study, have focused on what jobs could be automated using existing technologies. The findings have generally been most damning for lower wage, lower education workers, where robotics and software have often eliminated part or all of certain jobs. The specter of increased automation has raised concerns about how large swaths of Americans will be able to support themselves when their jobs become mechanized and whether the loss of low-income jobs will increase wealth inequality. This new patent research suggests automation's impact could be much broader and affect high-paying white-collar jobs as well. This is an interesting article to take into account because, indeed, it has been the blue-collar workers who were apparently decimated by automation. But this isn't true anymore. And the class of unemployables, by the way, that the elite think is coming because of AI and robotics, they may find themselves to be part of that class as well. The second story has absolutely nothing to do with the first, but it does have to do with technocracy for sure. The Bureau of Land Management, affectionately known as BLM, sparks this title. BLM continues to buy U.S. land from Nature Conservancy. Now, actually, there are several things packed into this article, but I wrote at the top, as of 2017, the BLM owned, get ready for this, 248 million acres of U.S. land and continues to expand its portfolio. The laundering of new land is often accomplished through the Nature Conservancy, as was the case in this recent purchase. The Nature Conservancy often acquires land through conservation easements, which it creates with landowners, where landowners retain a life estate of their property and then deed it to the Conservancy upon their death. The Conservancy turns around, typically will sell the land to BLM and make a tidy profit. Well, the Bureau of Land Management closed on a 5.6 million property purchase on Thursday that adds another 7,268 acres to public lands just north of the Blackfoot River. The purchase is from the Nature Conservancy and uses Land and Water Conservation Fund dollars, which is a federal program whose money comes from offshore oil and gas development. This brings the total of BLM-owned property and the drainage about 25 miles northeast of Missoula to about 27,000 acres, with the eventual goal of expanding the federal agency's land holdings in the area to 60,000 acres. The purchase price amounted to $775 per acre. Joe Ashore, the BLM's Missoula field manager, said the plan has been in the making for a couple of years. The nonprofit Nature Conservancy bought about 117,000 acres from Plum Creek in 2014 in the greater Blackfoot area to preserve the intact landscape and keep it from being subdivided into ranchettes. And by the way, that is the normal function of Nature Conservancy, is to buy land and then put it off limits to any development whatsoever. It continues, when the Nature Conservancy purchased the property, the nonprofit group said it didn't intend to retain ownership, but wanted to pass it on to the state and federal public agencies. Well, of course it did, and it always does so at a profit, I might add. The Nature Conservancy is an organization now, nonprofit as it is, that's worth well over $4 billion. A couple of comments are in order here. I have said for many years that the original goal of the Trilateral Commission and its invention of modern-day technocracy under the name of sustainable development was to grab the resources of the world, take them out of public hands, and put them into a global common trust managed by them. This was obvious to me even back in the late 1970s that it was a resource grab. And now that modern technocracy has been discovered as being the same as the Trilateral Commission's original New International Economic Order, we know for certain that it's a resource grab that everybody has in mind within the global elite. They know money is going to dry up. They know that all the fiat currencies of the world are going to go the way of the world and burn up one day. And the only thing that's left to them is to put their hands directly onto the resources themselves. And so the U.S. Constitution, as you may well be aware, does not provide for the federal government to own any property outside of land in certain areas, very small amounts of land, like in Washington, D.C., like some necessary ports and military facilities around the country. Otherwise, there is absolutely no constitutional mandate or allowance for the BLM or any other federal agency to own any significant amount of real estate. And yet, if you look at the map on this particular article, you will see exactly how much land the government owns around the country. Most of it is in the West, I might add, and in Alaska, but it's absolutely outrageous that all this land that is owned by the federal government has no tax base as far as the people living in those areas are concerned. And then we wonder why states in those areas are going bankrupt. It's because the land is actually owned by somebody else and there's no tax base, there's no value to get taxation off of it, because the federal government does not pay taxes back to a local state. So it's a catch-22. But in any case, the BLM, which now owns almost 250 million acres of prime U.S. land, is buying more. President Trump said that he wanted to sell off some of the land that's owned by the National Park Service and by the BLM and so on. That hasn't happened yet. And in the meantime, the BLM marches forward and continues to buy land. There's no way to predict where this will end, but at some point, there won't be any more land for the BLM to buy, I suppose. And of course, they're not buying land in the cities. They're only buying up land that's out in rural areas. And as I said, look at the map and you'll see that some rural areas are 100% owned and dominated by the BLM. This is absolutely not good for the future of America. The rest of the world is suffering in the same way. Those countries which got horribly in debt thanks to the World Bank and the IMF are now being offered deals called debt for land. And the deal is the World Bank will go in and say, we will forgive your interest for a period of time if you cede over to us large blocks of land in your country. We'll manage that land for you. You can still say that you own it in a way, but we will manage it for you and tell you what to do with it. And by the way, no development is allowed there. And we'll forgive some of that interest on that huge debt that you owe. Well, a lot of countries are going for that, figuring, well, what else can we do? So again, land is being snapped up around the world like crazy, and countries and people have less and less in their hands. This is a resource grab of epic proportions. It always has been, and until there's no more resources to grab, it always will be. The last story is just pure and simple preparation for what's coming. It's about ASU President Michael Crow, and he is indeed leading the sustainable charge in the West and probably all the way across the country as well. The title of the story is ASU President Michael Crow Leads Sustainable Development Charge, and indeed he does. A couple of recent articles that I have put up and a couple written myself talk about the so-called Smart Region Initiative that is being led by ASU. And the head of ASU is Michael Crow, and he is intimately leading that project himself. So here's a little introduction to Dr. Michael Crow. Michael Crow is a consummate technocrat who has created a new kind of educational experience at ASU, one that is measured by its social impact rather than traditional statistics like awards or intellectual rigor. Notably, Crow is also the chairman of the board of the CIA's venture capital firm, NQTEL. You heard me right, NQTEL, CIA, venture capital. His NQTEL bio states the following. This is a direct quote off their website. Michael M. Crow became the 16th president of Arizona State University on July 1, 2002. He is guiding the transformation of ASU into one of the nation's leading public metropolitan research universities, an institution that combines the highest level of academic excellence, inclusiveness to a broad demographic, and maximum societal impact, a model he designed known as the, quote, New American University. And I want to point to this, that the goal here is to maximize societal impact. It continues, under his leadership, ASU has established major interdisciplinary research incentives, such as the Biodesign Institute, Global Institute of Sustainability, and more than a dozen new transdisciplinary schools, and witness an unprecedented academic infrastructure expansion, tripling of research expenditures, and attainment of record levels of diversity in the student body. Crow was previously professor of science and technology policy and executive vice provost of, get ready, Columbia University, where he served as chief strategist of Columbia's research enterprise and technology transfer operations. Isn't that a coincidence? Columbia University, of course, is where technocracy began in 1932. The president at that time of Columbia University was Nicholas Murray Butler, who is now quite well known as the father of scientific progressivism. He was basically doing the same thing with Columbia back then that Crow is doing with ASU now. I mentioned to one academic once upon a time that technocracy began at Columbia University, and he snickered, and I said, why are you laughing? He said, well, nothing good ever came out of Columbia University. And I think that's probably true. This article states, to those who ask what ASU's ranking number one in innovation actually means, ask no further. Perhaps if you've seen a billboard or two or three on the Price Freeway, you may have noticed that ASU has been rated first in innovation from U.S. News and World Report for 5 consecutive years. Great, says ASU student Lorenzo Rios. So what does that really mean? Rios's voice echoes that of countless other students, many of them turning the university's capitalization on achievement into a lighthearted joke. Although the young scholars now exploit the ranking by sarcastically granting their friends nicknames like Innovator when they complete insignificant tasks, the real-life accomplishments from ASU Michael Crow are no joke. In his recent presentation to the Chandler Chamber of Commerce, Crow highlighted numerous ways that he and his staff have worked toward putting Arizona State at the top of America's list of robust academic institutions. Crow served as deputy provost and senior faculty member of Columbia University in New York City for 12 years before coming to ASU, where he has now been president for 17 years. Columbia, as Dr. Crow describes, was, quote, too small an arena and too rigid a place, close quote, despite the incredible opportunities he had there. In other words, he outgrew his pants there and came to Arizona where there's more room to expand. The article continues, the level of success we desire in the United States, he says, will not emerge from the establishment institutions like Columbia University, but rather from new places that are able to do things like ASU. He continues, quote, the opportunity here and the reason that I was hired was to take this very large public university, which had not yet matured, and see if you could actually build a new kind of university. Building this new class of education in America is something like ASU certainly has accomplished, with many well-established universities following Dr. Crow's example of innovation. Becoming number one in the U.S. for innovation is determined by a peer-based survey from Crow's counterparts in other academic institutions. According to the U.S. News & World Report, nominees must demonstrate innovative ways within their campuses to improve in categories such as curriculum, students, and faculty or campus facilities and technology. Dr. Crow describes the process of growth and development as a long and hard-fought game, but the outcome has proven to be worth the fight. Crow said, quote, ASU today is one of the 10 most significant patentors of all universities on the planet. We weren't even in the top several hundred when we started that process, he said. So yes, ASU is growing in global status. If a city could have the designation of, quote, global city, well, then universities ought to be able to have the title of global university. If that were made a title, ASU would probably receive the first designation. It should become clear to readers of Technocracy News and Trends that the reason I'm focusing on this is because I strongly believe now that the Phoenix area in central Arizona has become the epicenter of sustainable development, of technology transfer, of smart city technology implementation, and many other things as well. Largely, that is thanks to Dr. Michael Crow, president of Arizona State University, and also, just coincidentally, the chairman of the board of the CIA's venture capital firm, NQTEL. This man is connected and is using his connections to build the Phoenix area into a model that will be global in every way. The Phoenix and surrounding areas are aspiring to become truly a global city along the lines of a Los Angeles, a New York City, a Paris, a London, etc. Well, keep this in mind. As we move forward, there will be more coming from Arizona, you will see. And now you know a little bit about the man behind most of the innovation, that is the number one innovator in Arizona, ASU. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time.